Welcome to Rise from the Ashes. Our podcast looks at various issues for families. We'll be talking with attorneys about personal and legal concerns having to do with divorce, custody, and parenting time. There are also a few topics about letting go, moving on, and new beginnings. Please keep in mind this podcast is only to inform and help to understand legal and personal issues as they relate to family law. It should not be considered as a replacement for a qualified family law attorney. When in doubt, please contact a professional. Rise from the Ashes, focusing on matters of the family, because family matters. Hi, and welcome to our podcast, Rise from the Ashes. I'm David Braddock, your host, and today we're talking with Susan Mundahl and Carlo Ficini, both of Mundahl Law, a family law firm. How are you guys doing today?
I'm great, David. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm doing well, David.
For today's podcast, we'll be covering some of the top things not to do during a divorce. I understand you guys have some ideas about this. Susan, shall we start with you?
I think that would be great, David. There is a blog on this, so what we wanted to do was to talk about it in a more friendly fashion based on our experience. I do think the number one thing not to do during your divorce is to put out anything on social media. Please do not Twitter, do not Facebook, don't Pinterest.
There's so many. Even the dating websites, if you put a profile up, that's something that is certainly within each person's discretion. But don't badmouth your ex on that actual site.
Yes, please. Don't go on the dating websites until you're divorced. While it is not technically relevant, because all the courts care about is the irretrievable breakdown of the marriage, but I will tell you, it will increase the cost of getting a divorce because now you've ticked off the other side. And there is somewhat of a mentality, if I can't have you, no one can. Even though technically you can go out and date, I always recommend if you can't stop from dating, keep it quiet and certainly don't introduce the children to your friend. I realize that's a little off topic, but you're putting it out on social media that you're dating.
If you put it on the internet, it will stay on the internet? Is that one of the primary concerns here?
Absolutely. And in fact, I have a recent case where now they're asking me, what can I do to stop the other side from putting our children's pictures out on social media? So there is the second piece to it. Don't put your children out on social media while you're going through a divorce. It's just something that is just going to raise anger. And there is case law.
Yes, there is some case law on that. And also, there's now case law with OFPs as well. Oftentimes, we do see divorces where there is an order for protection in place. And now courts are actually saying, hey, if you're putting stuff on Facebook, if you're contacting the person through social media, if somehow that's getting back to that person, yes, that can be a violation. And now you're potentially looking at criminal charges on top of the divorce.
Right. Just related to that, don't put on social media your drunken brawls. Don't put on social media your two-year-old child with a beer bottle. Unfortunately, I have seen it raised, and all it does is confuse things. I'm assuming that someone thought it was cute to put the child next to a beer bottle and that the two-year-old had not actually drunk any, but just don't do it.
It muddies the waters.
Well, because the ex may bring it up during the divorce process.
Oh, yes. They will.
Okay.
I personally have not had the pleasure of seeing this one yet, but there certainly are plenty of stories about where individuals have conspired to impact their soon-to-be ex-spouse workplace or their job, or done things to try and get them essentially fired without even having seen this personally. It's not something you want to do. Susan, I'm sure you've seen this in your years.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen it in two different ways, but it usually is the angry spouse going to the other person's employer and telling them stories about what a terrible person their spouse is.
Yeah.
Usually making allegations that they're drunk. But if you're someone who wants to receive child support or spousal support, if you conspire to get your spouse fired, how do you expect to receive any money?
That seems like it's probably the main reason why this is not a good idea. If you mess with your ex at their work, that's going to possibly affect the amount of money that's going to be able to be spent on child support and etc.
Well, and if you're an obligor, meaning someone who's going to be paying child support or spousal support, you want to have the other person working also so that it reduces what you're expected to pay.
Okay.
I think another big one is to tell your spouse that he or she will never see the children again, which simply is not true 99% of the time. There is a statutory, what's the word, Carlo?
There's a rebuttable presumption.
Thank you.
It's a fancy word.
Yes.
But that's the legal term.
That is the legal term, is there's a rebuttable presumption. Right.
There is a rebuttable presumption of...
of a certain amount of parenting time.
For each parent. Is that what you're trying to say?
Right. Yes. And that rebuttable presumption is 25%. Yep. And the statutory site, if you want to look it up, is Minnesota Statute 518.175. The thing is that it's not true. The only way you would ever get it is, say, someone that was a murderer, really.
Yeah.
Or someone that has so severely harmed the children that they are about to lose their parental rights. Other than that, you're both going to see your children. You will always be your child's mother or your child's father. What the courts want is for the two of you to reach a parenting plan that's in the best interest of your children, that maximizes time with both of you.
And the court recognizes, not only from a legal standpoint, but even all of the psychological and medical research out there, as far as the developmental impact on children of having both parents be active in their lives, and how absolutely crucial and vital that is to a healthy development for a child.
The next one we have is, don't use your children as a messenger, confidant, or debt collector. What all of us are hoping, all of us divorce professionals, including judges and court personnel and guardian ad litems and you name it, the collective we want you to nurture and keep your children safe. Your children should not be another adult friend. And if you don't have any adult friends that you can talk to about those things, you should be going into counseling. I know you don't like your spouse. That's why you're getting a divorce. And you think it's just easier to, hey, tell your dad that his child support is due. Or tell your mom that I'm going to be picking you up on Friday. We think that it's easy for your children to do. But remember, your children love both of you. And they don't want to get in the middle. They want to be children. They want to play with their friends. And they want to do their stuff. And they certainly shouldn't be told, I can't get you that coat because your father hasn't paid child support, or vice versa. You know, your mother hasn't done this and your mother wants to spend her money. That's using them as confidants. None of that is appropriate. What you need to do is grow up. If you can't handle it, find yourself a trusted advisor, say a counselor or a coach, and talk to them about these things. I don't even necessarily recommend that you use family and friends for these conversations, because they will grow tired of hearing about your divorce long before you need to end talking about it. Then they're also messing in your business. Don't use your kids. That's the last people you should be using.
Because it seems like the children are going to remember this pretty much for the rest of their lives, including when they're adults, and there's going to be a certain amount of resentment, isn't there?
I had recently a meeting with a colleague of Susan's and mine on a case speaking about this notion of adultification. Your child has now lost their childhood, and you can't get that back. This improper, this ramping up, communication issues, and just treating the child as an adult, adultifying them, it does severely impact their development and really can hinder that child when they do grow into adulthood. At the proper stage.
Exactly. It could possibly even harm their ability to enter into satisfying adult relationships.
Yes.
Wow.
We don't want to put too fine a...
And I don't think we can put too fine a point. I think this is something we're really seeing as a family law bar a lot now, is this notion of parents going through a divorce, one parent or another decides, instead of being parent, that they're going to be
best friend. Great.
And then confides in the child, and that child is now essentially best friend, but as an adult, and hearing things that they should not hear and things that they should not be being exposed to about their other parent, or even the parent that's confiding things in them, things of a mature nature at times.
Well, and even if you're talking about custody and parenting time, there is nothing more bizarre than hearing a three-year-old say, Daddy just wants 50% time.
Yeah.
It's so inappropriate. The bottom line is, don't do it.
I've got one the vengeful selling of your spouse's vehicle or belongings. We've all seen the sitcom where all your property's getting thrown out the window, your clothes are getting thrown out the window or something. And it's funny when we see it in a sitcom, but it's not so funny when we actually have it on cases, right, Susan?
Right. In fact, a lot of what you see in the pawn shops, I understand yes. the tools that are there are actually ex-wives who have taken their husband's tools and put them at the pawn shop.
Yes. And jewelry, too. I mean, I've seen cases where we've had jewelry of the wife being sold.
Isn't that somewhat of a violation of some of the directive in the summons, the way I understand it?
It is, yeah.
How does that directive read again? Isn't it something about you're not allowed to tamper with any of the finances? So by selling property without agreement, isn't that a violation as such?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it includes the buying and selling of things. You're right. There isn't a lot of teeth
No.
to that, unfortunately.
Well, right, but you're already showing the court or the judge that you're willing to break the rules, so to speak, and so the judge isn't going to look too favorably on that, I wouldn't think, for your side of the case.
Well, if a judge actually sees it. Unfortunately, 95% of these settle. But it will definitely increase the cost and the time involved in getting that divorce done.
Yes.
Because anytime you're dealing with anger, it's going to cost time and money. And lawyers are expensive. And I really don't want to deal with that immature stuff on the part of my client or the other side.
Just to look at some of the fundamental parts of it, if the opposing counsel sees that, they're going to demand that that get repaid or returned in some fashion, and that's going to cost attorney time on both sides.
Absolutely. And the bottom line is, by being respectful during the divorce, you are guaranteeing that you will have a respectful relationship with your ex-spouse for the rest of your children's lives. That's what you need to think about. In the moment, you're satisfying your need, your anger, but in the long run, it is going to affect your relationship with your children. And there's nothing worse than a child who feels they have to go and try and find something that daddy had stolen from mommy or mommy had stolen from daddy. Again, this is not a good thing to do in your divorce.
There's still a relationship that potentially is going to have to be in place. And civility, ultimately, is what needs to happen. And it traces through so many of these reasons, but even the question we get about how to keep costs down or how to have a quick running divorce, there is still going to be a relationship intact at some level, whether there be children or not.
I think you're absolutely right, Carla. And that kind of leads into our next one.
Is this a common thing where people go out and go on a drunken bender?
It's common enough. And, you know, the drunken bender in and of itself is potentially not harmful if you're doing it at home. The problem is, all of a sudden, I have a client who no longer has the money to pay me because they have to hire a defense attorney because they got a DUI.
Or you get the issues where the client decides, because they're inebriated, because they're drunk and their judgment is hindered, hey, it's a good idea to text my ex a million times.
Right.
Or do these malicious things like break a headlight on the car or things of that nature. And that is where they may not necessarily need a defense attorney, depending on what they do, but they do need to be giving us more money now because we have to put out a fire of a potential harassment issue.
Right.
Or just the fact that those drunken texts are now being submitted at a mediation or in court as evidence to their ability to effectively parent.
I see.
And let's talk about the absolutely dumbest thing you can do is to drink and drive with your children in the car.
Yes.
Now you've taken your stupidity to an entirely new level. And excuse me for calling it that, but your children should never be in a vehicle where you are impaired driving.
Right, because you're putting even your children's lives in danger as well as everyone else on the road with you.
And now you're just going to increase the cost of your divorce. And now there's got to be extra provisions about you being sober when you have the children.
Or treatment programs.
Right.
That's a common thing we see now where because of those instances where someone has been inebriated operating a vehicle with the children, I've even seen it on cases where they've just been in the presence of the children drunk, fall down drunk. What's happened as a result is a condition of the parenting time, if not having supervised parenting time, which is where you go to a center and you have time with your kids while someone watches you.
To make sure that you're not under the influence.
Right.
Exactly.
I've also seen ones where there have been conditions that you have to attend an AA or you have to attend an outpatient, some sort of treatment.
Right. And it could have been just based on this one-shot drunken bender idea.
Right. Yes. You're absolutely right. And so let me offer an alternative. Take a yoga class.
Yeah. Or go for a run.
Attend an exercise class. Yeah. There are positive ways to deal with your anger. In fact, you can even go to one of those gyms where you punch a bag.
I was just going to say, you could join a boxing gym.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Just release your stress. There are plenty of healthy ways to do that.
What about this one? Do people actually break into their own house, I suppose, because they're trying to get their stuff or somebody's stuff?
You know, let me talk about that one a minute. Because I, in fact, in the last month, I've had two people ask this question about can they change the locks on the house? And technically speaking, your spouse has a right to be in the house absent a court order. And that court order can be due to an order for protection or a temporary order from the court. But don't go there. That's what I'm suggesting. The reason someone wants to change the locks is they're afraid. So if you come back, you run the risk that the other party is going to file for an order for protection if fear is involved. Right. If it is simply getting stuff, you are far better off reaching an agreement on what's in the home, what remains in the home, and how it should be divided, and do it as a part of this property settlement instead of going in and doing self-help. The only time to really look at taking the things is if you believe the other party is going to destroy them.
Aren't there early stages of this property division so that if somebody has to leave the home in an early stage of their separation, that they're allowed to come and get stuff, some of their most immediate things? Doesn't the court allow for that so you can take care of some of those things right away?
In an order for protection, yes.
Right.
Again, going back to what Carlos said about civility, certainly if the parties are civil, then together they can make arrangements for, hey, I'm going to come over this Saturday and get my stuff. And the two of them, if they're really civil, they can go through the house together and they can decide, oh, you take that, I'll take this. That's the best way to do it.
While I would applaud those people that do that with civility, I would also caution, do get some sort of recording of what was taken, whether it be a writing or something, just in case things happen down the road and somebody accuses someone of taking something that wasn't taken. Just get something. It doesn't have to be a court-ordered document or a formal document. Even if it's just a checklist on a piece of paper that both parties sign and date, that's fine.
Just a brief exchange of emails could do it, wouldn't it? If it shows that there's some agreement on particular items?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
There's so much less paper these days. It seems like if you even just did a little note on your phone, we agreed that this will work for this item, my pants, my underwear, those kinds of things. Yeah, that'll be great. That'll be fine.
Even
we'll take care of it on Saturday.
Right. Yeah. And what the courts will tell you is that if the two of you can't reach an agreement on things, they will suggest that it's sold. But that's ridiculous because I had the case where they were both ordered to bring the items to be sold at auction, and wife brought hers, husband didn't. All of her things got sold off, and then she's supposed to give him half where he didn't even bring anything to it. And so it creates a huge problem. I'm with you, Carlo. The bottom line is be civil. If you have children, you have to maintain a relationship with this person for the rest of your children's lives.
And the grandchildren's lives. It really can impact the family for generations. Going off that point, though, as far as the court, what they'll do, one of the common things I've seen among the family bar when writing agreements is if you can't come to an agreement as to the disposition or how to get rid of property, you'll have to go to binding arbitration. And that's where you go among a third party neutral and they just say who's getting what and why.
So that's something the court will require the couple to do.
Usually, yes. Yeah. And just remember, that costs money. The average arbitrator, they cost about $300 an hour. Wow. So here's the bottom line. Don't spend thousands of dollars arguing about hundreds of dollars worth of stuff. In fact, I had one case where husband really didn't want the divorce, and so he kept putting off going back in and getting the stuff he was supposed to, including half the kitchen stuff. That's what it said in the decree. Yeah. So one week after the divorce, he calls me, and he says, she won't let me in to get my kitchen stuff. And I says, well, tell you what, go to William Sonoma and buy top-of-the-line stuff because that's what it's going to cost you to have me go back to the court to get you that kitchen stuff.
Yep.
Wow, good point.
Yeah. So don't steal your stuff, but work it out in a reasonable, civil fashion.
Here's one about paperwork. You'd think that folks would want to make sure they read all of their paperwork each time that they receive something from their attorney.
Well, you'd think, but you have to remember that our clients are going through the grief cycle, and one of the factors is denial. And so they figure that if they just don't open it, it's not happening. And that is a really poor response.
Right. Right, absolutely. I mean, so much of what we send, we try not to send more than we need to because we're very cognizant and sensitive to what our clients are going through. But if we send it, you need to read it.
It's important.
Yeah, it's vital. And so much of that is at times disregarded. Or you'll see times where a client asks the same question a couple times and, oh, nope, if you read the email or read what was sent before, I've already answered it, but now you have to be billed. I mean, you're accruing costs.
If it's repeat information,
yes,
you need to charge for your time the same as you did the first time.
Yeah.
So it's better to just make it only happen once.
That's
right,
correct.
Exactly.
Usually the biggest paperwork is when we're trying to get a case settled. Mm-hmm. And so there's very important language. Now, when you look at the average stipulated judgment and decree, it's 20 or 30 pages long. If there's children, it's around 30 pages. So it is a lot to read. But you have to do it. It is your life, so do it. Read it with a fine-tooth comb. Read it first thing in the morning when your brain is fresh. Be thorough and then call your attorney and make the appointment to make the changes. But don't just slop your way through it, because for us, what may be letters and numbers to us, it's not our life. We might leave out something really important. Not that we want to, but we're human. So in the end, I always tell my clients, the final review is yours. And this is only as good as your review.
And as much of an advocate as I am for paperless, especially on those last documents, I advocate for my clients to print off a copy, read it, mark it up, put those questions on paper, because there are so many times where if it's on a screen, you may not catch it, but if it's actually in print, it gives it more weight, I think, and it speaks to the importance of the document. And also, you're able to put the thoughts right down, just jot it right down so that you have it. So then when you do come in to review with your attorney, whatever that document is, your questions are right there in ink.
And what I tell my entire staff, whenever we do documents, I tell them to read it out loud.
Right.
Because if you've seen those things on Facebook where they take out all of the vowels and you can still read what the sentence is,
yes,
that's what you're doing. Your brain is automatically putting stuff in. Whereas if you read it out loud, you're more apt to catch any of the mistakes.
Is it true some people apparently lie to the attorney? That's not a good thing to do.
To quote House, everyone lies. You know, in fact, I'm not even Catholic, but I love that they talk about sins of omission.
Yes.
And sins of commission. And really, dealing with clients is like peeling an onion. They really don't share a lot with you to begin with. And yet, it's the stuff they leave out that sometimes can be very important. Like a second job.
Right.
Or they have a new girlfriend.
Yeah.
And again, while technically it's not relevant, it really is relevant to the amount of anger we're dealing with from the other side.
Especially because so many of those things are of a nature where the other side, that ex or soon to be ex, knows about it, but we don't.
Right.
And it impacts the new girlfriend or the new boyfriend. They've met the child, and it causes so much of a potential for a firestorm that we have to deal with and put out.
So it'll come out through the opposing counsel or something like that.
Right.
And then you're going to have to put out the fire or at least inform yourself properly through your client.
Right.
Yes, to start with.
And then there's just the bald-faced lies, saying that you don't own certain property, that you've sold certain property and it's sitting in your garage. Don't lie to your attorney. Don't lie to the other side. Each party has an affirmative duty to say what their assets are and what their liabilities are.
Yeah.
And an affirmative duty means you can't wait for the other side to ask you, do you have that? You have to be willing upfront to list all of it ahead of time. Otherwise, you run the risk of the whole thing being thrown out as fraud upon the court.
Yeah, and the biggest issue really is the unknown unknowns. It's these things that we don't know as attorneys that the client isn't telling us. There is no indication to us that the client has X. And that X may be a really big deal, whatever that piece of property is or that piece of information is. We need to know that. It's better as a client to tell us more up front than to risk not telling us enough.
Because you can qualify how that will fit into the case or not.
It right.
Might not be that relevant or actionable as a term that I've heard you use in the past, Carlos.
Yes, exactly.
That's right. The bottom line is please don't lie to your attorney. Whether you are keeping something from them that you don't think they need to know, but if it's niggling at your conscience, they need to know. Because if it's bothering you, then chances are it is relevant to the case. Let us make a determination on whether that's something that we need to know or not.
And we will let you know up front when you tell us. We will say, okay, no, we don't need to know things like that. So that then as a client, you know, okay, this is either something I have to deal with through another avenue, or this is something I just need to hit a punching bag about for 20 minutes or whatever it is.
Let me just say one brief case. I had a client who had me draft an affidavit, and an affidavit is you're swearing that what facts you're presenting are true. And he said that he only had one DUI, but he had just been arrested for a second DUI. We went to court and he had an affidavit that was false. And guess what? The judge we drew knew about that other one, and she dressed him down and he lost parenting time. She gave him only supervised parenting time and very limited, and she dressed him down for lying to her. And I had another client who swore up and down she had not used any meth, had me put it in an affidavit, and she was pregnant at the time. And when her baby was born, the husband went and told the police to do a well baby check, and both the baby and mother tested positive for meth.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of lies that you cannot expect are going to be kept hidden. They're going to come out and you're going to look bad.
Yep.
That brings us to our last point about one of the things not to do when you're going through a divorce. Try not to get pregnant. It makes it a mess and keeps it going longer. That's the bottom line, is that a lot of judges will refuse to divorce you until the baby is born. It doesn't matter whether the baby is your husband's or the baby is your new partner. It does mess things up and it can keep it going long. Just understand, it's even with 180 days of your divorce.
Yes.
Your husband remains a presumed father for paternity purposes.
By the court.
By the court,
yeah,
yes.
By statute.
By statute, yes.
I see.
So it is really important. Do your best. Whatever birth control method you need, I recommend abstinence, quite frankly. Get out of one relationship before you enter into another, but I'm a realist. So be careful and understand that if you are pregnant, it is an important issue in the divorce. It's one that you need to be honest about. And
don't lie to the attorneys about that.
Right.
Going back to our last point.
Yes, and tell us as soon as possible. But understand then that you probably will not be able to get your divorce finalized until after the child is born.
Right.
Is there anything else that you would like to add about any of these items?
I actually wish you all the best, and I really hope that you will have a sane civil divorce.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, Carlo.
Thank you, David.
You are listening to Rise from the Ashes, the podcast channel that takes a careful look at all things having to do with legal procedure within the family law process. Rise from the Ashes is sponsored by Mundahl Law, who specializes in assisting families and individuals through the legal process with respect, dignity, and caring. Mundahl Law is dedicated to helping people to solve their legal problems. You can visit the Mundahl Law website at mundahllaw.com or call to schedule a consultation with one of their qualified family law attorneys. Rise from the Ashes, focusing on matters of the family, because family matters.